and innocent unarmed Palestinian refugees into exile. Notwithstanding the bloodthirsty demands of the religious fanatics that Amalek be wiped out with his women and children, we can safely assume that Sharon's plan will not call for mass murder, and that the killing that will be involved will only be that which is necessary to terrify and force the Palestinians to flee. Logic, not prophecy. Does it require some special expertise, secret sources or prophetic POWs to justify projecting the scenario just described? Not at all. It is simply a logical progression from the known facts. Among the facts that are well known are these: Israel's dilemma must be solved soon, and Sharon knows it. He is no procrastinator. Sharon also knows that simply putting down the Intifada solves nothing, because the 1,500,000 Palestinians still remain in the West Bank and Gaza. If Sharon, or anyone in the liquid with his philosophy, comes to power, it will be on the promise of a final solution to the Palestinian problem. Sharon is on record that the Palestinians belong in Jordan, not on the West Bank and Gaza, and that Jordan should be their homeland. He has also stated emphatically that the US should not get involved. The Palestinian problem is for Israel to handle. His supporters among the religious extremists are condemning the present Israeli government as too timid in solving the Palestinian problem, and have demanded that the Palestinians, Amalek, be driven out of the sacred occupied lands, or God will not allow the Israelis to continue living in Israel and will not send the Messiah. The West Bank settlers are bitterly critical of the Israeli government for not sending enough troops into the occupied territories to protect them from the stone-throwing Palestinians. Sharon's supporters are agreed that with Israel's military power, they have nothing to fear from anyone, and that Israel's Palestinian problem can be solved with one bold stroke. All that is needed is a leader with the courage to do it. The only reason for the present delay in expelling the Palestinians is that the Sharon faction is not yet in full control of the Israeli government. But have we been imputing to Sharon intentions and motivations that are too extreme to be taken seriously? The answer is only if Sharon has never meant anything he has ever said or done. Moreover, Sharon is by no means alone among the highest levels of the Israeli military in his attitude toward the Palestinians. General Eaton, Israel's chief of staff during the Lebanon War, testified before the Knesset Foreign Relations and Defense Committee just before his retirement in April 1983. Shipler, in his book Arab and Jew, writes, Eaton told the legislators that many more Jewish settlements had to be built on the West Bank, that if there were 100 settlements between Jerusalem and Nablus, Arabs would not be able to throw stones. When we have settled the land, all the Arabs will be able to do about it will be to scurry around like drugged roaches in a bottle, declared Israel's highest military officer. The remark triggered a storm of outrage among many Israeli Jews, but it also prompted expressions of admiration for Eaton, who showed up in public opinion polls a month later as the country's leading choice for chief of staff. In 1984 he was elected to the Knesset. An outraged Israeli writer said that Eaton's remarks were intended to dehumanize the Palestinians so that the military's job becomes easier. Cockroaches are not killed, they are exterminated. A holy war. The religious extremists have a worshipful attitude toward the militant generals in the Israeli army command. Huckabee explains that, for the extremists, Israel's might is a guarantee that no harm will befall them. According to Rabbi Zed Wycock, the IDF is holy and even its weapons are holy, for all that some of them are manufactured abroad by non-Jews and idolaters. Generals who openly violate religious precepts are venerated like saintly rabbis. A phenomenon which is perhaps related is the creeping militarization of religious language, and perhaps even of religious thought. Maimonides would be dumbfounded to hear a rabbi like Rabbi Hess speak of the personal interest of a God who mobilizes himself. The faith in Israel's military capacity becomes a functional, psychological, and cognitive need, because without this faith the entire theological structure, including the idea that we are living at the beginning of the redemption, would collapse. Little wonder that this faith is in full flower. Israel is stronger than all the forces in the Middle East, they believe, and not even the Soviets dare raise a finger. In this view, setbacks are caused not by intrinsic limitations of Israeli might, but by a leadership that is too timorous to exploit the means at its disposal. Such a faith is a vital part of the worldview of the extremists who have settled in the occupied territories, because it seems to offer an insurance policy against the collapse of their entire enterprise. Thus, an analysis of the evidence almost compels the conclusion reached here regarding Sharon's intentions in pursuing his final solution. Indeed, 1. Sharon has no doubt as to what should be done about the Palestinians too. His fiery and highly vocal supporters are crying that it must be done. 3. Sharon knows the only way that it can be done. 4. If he is elected prime minister, he will have the power to do it. Conclusion: that is what Sharon will do. But what about Israel herself? Is the final solution of the Palestinian problem the final solution for Israel's dilemma or the final chapter? For of course, no one can predict for certain what the fate of Israel would be under the circumstances described, and we do not presume to do so. Although a number of thoughtful minds in Israel have expressed the fear of another Holocaust or an Armageddon or a Muslim jihad, we refrain from predicting any of these, our purpose being satisfied by pointing out and analyzing the danger of such a catastrophe happening. Proceed, therefore, on the assumption that the Palestinian expulsion will become a fait accompli without provoking military action against Israel, what would the reaction be from the world community? We can, of course, only speculate. But it can be said with some degree of certainty that the United Nations cannot remain indifferent. Let us assume then the mildest response that can be expected or imagined from the world community. It is inconceivable that the UN sanctions against Israel would not be more severe than those imposed on South Africa. In the eyes of the world, nothing that South Africa has done would begin to compare with Israel's crime if it expelled the Palestinians. The following would in all likelihood be among the penalties incurred. 1. A severance of diplomatic relations with Israel by most nations. 2. The expulsion of Israel from the UN. This has almost happened on a number of past occasions when the provocation was far less. 3. A trade embargo and boycott against Israel in which most all nations, as far as the US is concerned, it is impossible to say what it would do. But regardless of the US reaction, the sweeping economic sanctions of the rest of the world would be ruinous for Israel. The price that Israel might have to pay to lift economic sanctions could well be an imposed peace on the basis of the UN partition resolution and its 1948 boundaries, as well as nuclear disarmament. It is hard to imagine Israel accepting these conditions, particularly nuclear disarmament, when its paranoia regarding the rest of the world would then be confirmed by reality. What then would Israel's response be? Can Israel retaliate against economic isolation and eventual strangulation by a nuclear strike? If so, against whom? When and how does Israel play its nuclear card? Japan responded to economic isolation in 1941 by the Pearl Harbor attack, the 1941 version of a nuclear strike, and began a war in Chapter 11. We cited the great concern expressed from many quarters, including the Soviet Union, about the escalating nuclear missile race, and it is ironic that the US and the Soviet Union have, after 40 years, begun to engage seriously in reducing their nuclear weapons stockpiles, while, at the same time, the Middle East is rushing toward Armageddon, with Israel building the same type nuclear missile that Washington and Moscow have. An article published in the November 6, 1989, issue of Newsweek entitled "Israel's Deal with the Devil" reports on recent disclosures in the Middle East nuclear missile race. The following is an excerpt from the 4 years now. It has been a more or less open secret in defense circles that Israel is engaged in military collaboration with the apartheid government of South Africa. Israel is thought to be South Africa's largest arms supplier. Some Israelis say the relationship is necessary for their survival. Other people see it as a deal with the devil, which explains last week's fuss over a pair of reports on NBC News. The network charged that Jerusalem was involved in a full-blown partnership